You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Government Studies here at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to this event on new advances in transportation and service delivery. So there are a number of new features in the transportation area. Autonomous vehicles are being tested in major cities. Ride-sharing services are becoming more prominent. Remote sensors are gathering information on road conditions, traffic, and weather, as well as other things. And unmanned aerial systems are being deployed for firefighting, disaster relief, and law enforcement, among other areas. As an example, at the time of the Notre Dame Cathedral fire in Paris, drones helped firefighters locate the location of the fire and the intensity of the flames, and then that enabled them to devise certain strategies. And so that was a way to gather information at a time when people were not exactly sure what was happening. But at the same time that we have all these new developments, there are very important issues in terms of personal privacy, human safety, legal liability, and the kinds of regulations that we need in order to deal with these types of issues. So, question in terms of how privacy can be maintained in the face of smart transportation features. How should federal and state agencies oversee these new technologies? How should we think about some of these new models going forward? So to help us with these issues, we have three distinguished experts here with us today. So Mark Bartrick is Director of the Office of Aviation Services at the U.S. Department of the Interior. Darshan Devarkaran is a program engineer in the North Carolina Department of Transportation. And Margaret Taylor is a fellow in our government studies program at Brookings and also a senior editor and counsel at Lawfare. So, Mark, I'd like to start with you. So tell us how the Department of Interior is using these technologies. Earlier you were telling us Interior manages over 500 million acres in the United States, so that certainly is a major responsibility. What have your experiences been? What's worked well? What hasn't worked well?
Well, thanks, Darrell. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. For in Department of Interior, with the vast responsibilities we have as the largest land steward in America, of your land, all public land, it's really been a game changer for us. And we see benefits in what we call the four S's. We're a science-based organization. We manage your land based on the science that we get from sensing. So we are able to get more persistent sensing with better resolution. We are able to take that that data and analyze it and be transparent about it because we've recorded it through the use of unmanned aircraft systems. So we're better managing through better sensing. Safety is our second S. We aren't necessarily taking many pilots out of the cockpit, although we are removing some of them from some of our most dangerous missions. But we are reducing the risk for many of our employees on the ground who have done a lot of these missions in traditional ways that are very dangerous, like inspecting dams by putting an engineer over the side on a rope to inspect the dam. We don't have to do that anymore with drones. And then third one is savings. You know, our entire fleet of over 670 drones within the Department of the Interior costs less than many of the single manned aircraft that we fly. There's training savings. There's maintenance savings. We've flown over 20,000 flights, and I think we've had 10 mechanical failures out of those 20,000 flights. They're very reliable. And we've saved over $14 million last year alone on just operational savings by substituting small unmanned aircraft for those traditional methods. And then the final one is service. We get about 49% of the vote about when we're going to go out and do our missions, whether that's fire, flood, volcano, or even migrations and you know checking on your land, search and rescue certainly. And so we're much more responsive when we can take that aircraft literally out of someone's backpack rather than going down to the airport and scheduling a helicopter. So those are the four things that we've really seen a real game changer in our department.
Okay, thank you. So, Darshan, you work in the North Carolina Department of Transportation, and I know over the weekend you were busy with the Hurricane Dorian, and he was telling us earlier that they conducted 50 flights just to try and keep track of possible risk right there. Tell us about your experience and how the state is thinking about this topic.
Sure. So as mentioned, with the Hurricane Dorian, luckily nothing major happened. But with the Hurricane Florence last year, we were well prepared with disaster response. With Hurricane Florence, we had over 250 flight missions as conducted. And it was the first time where it was organized, between well organized, where private and public sector worked together with federal agencies, your traditional state agencies that are responding to disasters with no incidents, no accidents. So that was a great game changer for us, was that we could work with traditional agencies that wouldn't earlier accept the help provided to them. But when it comes to North Carolina DOT and North Carolina as such, we have a history to, keep up with the Wright brothers. We have to continue that tradition of being first in everything. I hope no one from Ohio is here. You keep checking if it is.
Actually, I was born in Ohio. So.
Too bad. If you have, we can't change the history, but we take the credit for everything they did in North Carolina. And for us, the main thing is that we would like to be first in everything that's good. And we started with first in drone safety in 2017, where we started integrating safety training programs, workshops, conferences that focused on educating our agencies, our public safety folks, our recreational pilots, everyone. Even folks who are not interested in flying drones but would just like to know about drones, we started with that. But then we also moved towards being first in medical package delivery, which took place. The first test was done last year, but actually right now the operations are live, taking place every week at Wakeman Hospital, where Matternet and UPS have partnered together and able to do medical package delivery. The thing is, the whole fact is that things are changing, and it's changing at a fast pace. For North Carolina DOT, we are the number one DOT in the nation for integrating drone technology, because we do everything and anything that's related to drones. We don't focus just on infrastructure and monitoring and inspection, but we do beyond that. We get into research, where we have worked with agencies like State Highway Patrol on crash scene reconstruction. We have gone to underwater vegetation mapping with environmental folks, disaster response, package delivery, working with our recreational pilots to find spaces to fly. Altogether, our role has been not just a focus within the state, but it's been a national thing. We have become a national leader in education and outreach, and we hope to continue that tradition with this technology moving forward.
Okay. So, Margaret, we've heard a little bit about the details at the state and federal levels in terms of how particular agencies are using some of these new models. How do you see the policy and regulatory issues in this space? What should we be worried about? How should we be thinking about these topics?
So I think, if I may, start with a little bit of sort of illustrative examples of interesting things that people are using drones for, because I think it kind of shows rather than tells what some of the challenges are. So let me just go through a few. I think these are really interesting and fascinating. When we think of drones in the commercial space, I think probably all of us are thinking delivery. Now, Amazon is working, obviously, on these programs. You can imagine a drone delivering things in urban areas to homes, delivering to remote rural areas. Very exciting, very efficient, presumably. So that's an interesting space. So I'm going to go through each of the interesting applications and then come back to some of them and explain some of the risks. So agriculture, lots of potential in the agriculture space. There are these really cool predator birds called roe birds that can be deployed across a field, scaring away other birds that eat the crops, so you can preserve more of your crops. precision agriculture, you know, drone swarms that can tell a farmer, you know, exactly what's going on in his fields very efficiently. Location drones, this is a really interesting one, that can track specific animals in a herd. So, like, use facial recognition software on a cow, a particular cow that might be sick, or that can come in and, for example, diagnose a sick cow. So you can imagine just all these really interesting things that could make farming and agriculture more efficient. Fighting a wildfire, which was referred to earlier, flying a drone over a wildfire can yield really valuable information for firefighters about where the fire is, where it's going, how to stop it. Law enforcement, surveillance applications. I read a statistic that 3 out of 4 public safety agencies say they are already operating drones or working on implementing a drone program to assist in their law enforcement efforts. So, you know, better tools for them. This has already been discussed briefly, improvements in emergency response, healthcare and medical applications. And just the last one, climate related. I think these are really fascinating. You can go on YouTube and see drones being flown over, you know, beautiful mountains and glaciers. And you can just imagine it's being done using those drones to, you know, monitor climate change, to see what's going on with glaciers in remote areas where currently it's very difficult to get to. Other things, you know, using drones to generate electricity from high-altitude winds, using something called a box-wing drone. That's sort of in development. So all these interesting things, lots of possibility. Private industry is just pursuing this and is really being very inventive. But as we all know, there are risks associated with these things. And when there are risks associated with, for example, public safety, that's where regulation comes in. That's where policy comes in. And I'll just go through. So back to delivery systems. Back in May in Switzerland, a 22-pound Swiss Post drone crashed about 50 yards away from a group of children. That drone program was suspended at that time. And these questions are really tactile because what happened with that drone, as I understand it, is that the parachute that deployed once the drone was falling out of the sky actually shredded. And so the questions, you know, they're asking themselves, and lots of jurisdictions are asking themselves, are what are exactly the right safety standards, you know, do we need a backup parachute, you know, 2 ropes instead of 1? Like, how is it going to work exactly? Because when you have a drone crash near a bunch of children, that gets people, you know, scared and engaged and against the technology. Also in the delivery system, you know, fears, we were talking about this earlier, fears of jobs going away. Right now, Amazon, you know, there's a guy who drives a truck and he pulls up in front of your house and he brings a package right up. So, you know, what's that guy going to do? Is he going to, you know, about now be a drone operator? Like, what's going to happen? Is he going to be trained to do that? Law enforcement, and I think we'll get into more of this, Daryl, but you have to balance civil liberties, obviously. Privacy concerns. Citizens are going to wonder what the police are doing with the information that is being collected as it flies over, for example, a protest, taking pictures of everyone who's engaged in the protest. There also needs to be deconfliction with manned aircraft, the avionics of manned aircraft when you use drones. Firefighting, especially firefighting, when an unauthorized drone enters a wildfire space, so like somebody either with malicious intent or just a clueless person who's like, oh, I'm going to fly my drone and there's a wildfire nearby, that means all of the helicopters and planes that are fighting the fire have to then be grounded. So you have to deal with the unauthorized UAS that might be coming into that system. And finally, climate. Back to climate. I just heard this a couple of days ago. Some climate activists in near Heathrow Airport, it's called Heathrow Pause. I guess Heathrow is adding another runway. And some climate activists are planning to use commercial drones to fly them into the no-fly 5-kilometer zone to protest the addition of that runway to highlight the impact of air travel on the environment. And that's scheduled to begin on September 13th. Unclear how long it will last. Probably those operators of those drones will be arrested. They're actually asking for drone operators to volunteer to come in and operate the drones as people get arrested so that more can backfill. So, you know, this is a complicated space. There's upside and there's downside too, and the risks need to be sort of dealt with, and that takes the regulatory regime. But I would say, Daryl, and then I'll conclude my comments here. You know, this technology, I'm a governance person. I'm not really like a drone person per se. This technology, it is just a new technology, and all of the tools that we usually use to regulate and, you know, infuse these technologies with our values, it's the same process and the same types of considerations for any technology. So I don't see this as a brand new sort of sui generis space. We should be using the tools that we have in the policy regulatory space to mitigate risks to people and also promote the benefits.
Okay, thank you. So Mark, Margaret has raised a number of policy and regulatory issues, privacy, surveillance, human safety, with law enforcement. Like, how long should the data collected through unmanned systems actually be stored? How is Interior thinking about these issues? And by the way, we did try and get a representative from the FAA, which is the major agency in this area, to speak on the panel, but we're not able to. We're not successful in doing that. Are there changes the FAA needs to make in response to some of these policy and regulatory issues?
So I think to start with the first part of your question, what are we doing? The good news is, as Margaret said, these are aircraft. By definition, they are aircraft. And thanks to the great state of Ohio and North Carolina, we've had aircraft for over 100 years now. So we're getting pretty good at how to operate these things. And I say that when it comes not only to safety, but also to privacy and being a nuisance, you know, whether that's noise or, you know, just buzzing people. We already have laws against that kind of stuff. And the other good thing is we've had law enforcement done from the air for as long as we've had, pretty much as long as we've had aircraft. So all of those policy decisions about, you know, what you can take from the air in terms of imagery and sensing and how long you can keep that data, thankfully, has already been handled by law enforcement professionals and policy professionals, and so we didn't have to reinvent that. It was reiterated in 2015 with a presidential memo on privacy and transparency that President Obama signed, and all the agencies that are operating drones, Interior being one of those, has a privacy impact assessment. You go on our website, which we're very proud of, is chock full of information. And you can see how we use the drones and how long we keep the data and how we keep that data, depending on, you know, what we're taking. You know, the one thing we have been very keen about in our program is to emphasize that the data is currency, and just because you have an object you're trying to take an image of, you're probably taking imagery of other things. And so our biggest thing that we've done in privacy is we train all of our operators, all of our program managers to talk to the public before you launch. Because if you tell people what you're going to do, and you're probably not going to tell them you're doing an active law enforcement operation, but you're doing a search and rescue, you're doing a habitat survey, wildfire, you tell them you're out there doing that, they're always very appreciative. And the one question they ask is, hey, can we see the video? It's probably pretty cool. And then once you do that, they put their imaginations to bed and it's all good. So I think it's really just a lot of common sense, both on the safety and the privacy side.
Darshan, I'll put the same question to you. At the federal level, what types of new policies and or new regulations do we need to consider? And then secondly, because you're operating at the state level, what about the differing jurisdictions of state versus federal agencies? How is that working out, and are there changes we need to make there?
So, as Mark pointed out on the privacy issue, yes, there is the whole concern on who's using and what's the data coming out of it. But when it comes to state agencies, I would say that for us, it's not the FAA, slowing the progress down technically. It's more states are themselves slowing the progress. There are some states who are ready to move ahead faster, but there are some states who are still figuring out who is going to lead a drone program within the state, who's going to do what in the state. You know, I've talked to states where they are having a basic issue of I would say like half of the DOTs out there are still figuring out who should be the UAS champion within their agency. And, you know, when we are trying to move this technology further, you know, in a faster pace, if you take manned aviation, which has taken over 100 years to, and it's still trying to perfect the whole model, you have unmanned systems that you're expecting within 5 years to keep up with manned aviation. And the reality is that's not possible. And the only way to do that for state agencies is to work with the federal agencies to see how you know, data can be shared to them, how you know, with the integration pilot program, the FAA's U.S. integration pilot program, there's a great opportunity for state and local government agencies to work with tribal government and everyone to work with FAA to help. You know, there's three main focus was. One was how state and local government agencies, tribal government agencies can regulate the airspace below 400 feet, can help regulate. And then second was how do we bring in new innovation and technology, not just within United States, but outside companies to come together. And third was how does this also help in the economic development benefit for the states and for United States overall. All this really, you know, it is like one and a half, it's about 2 years into it. And there's a lot of success coming out of it, which, you know, which was not, you know, 2 years back, you wouldn't see this. And when we were sitting on the other side of the table, we felt that regulations were restricting. It's not there. To get regulations in place, FAA needs data. And the only way for FAA to get data is where public, private sector work together and provide the data. And for a state like ours, you know, North Carolina, many of the folks who are sitting down here are partners with us, and they have worked with us to make this successful. The success of a program is also the success of the industry and the people working with it. So when we are sharing this data, FAA is ready to work creating new regulations. So the Part 135 came out of all this. How did this, you know, before getting into the integration pilot program, no one even thought about 135 operations, and 135 operations always existed in the man side.
Could you explain what 135 operations?
The 135 are? Operations. So, in the manned aviation side, you have your air carriers that transport people. You know, your airlines and everything, and then you have package delivery and cargo delivery. Those are your 135 operators, and how they operate is way different. You know, from commercial air carriers and everything. So, there are certain you know, regulations around it. You know, which could be like. Pages, maybe as you know, multiple pages. And when it comes to unmanned side, they realize that your Part 107 operation, that's your FAA Part 107 license, is not enough for package delivery. So they came up, said that Part 135 operations. Now, Part 135 operations is not something which we can just give a sheet of paper and say you need to X mark all these things and give us everything. FAA is figuring out what for manned aviation might have been thousands of pages, how does it become 100 pages or less for the unmanned systems side? So how do so we are working, not just us, but other nine states are also working with FAA to see where what is required, you know, things like airworthiness for aircrafts, training standards for aircrafts. All these things are coming into practice so that after this, any and every company is able to, you know, replicate this process. And FAA, you know, can change the regulations wherein, say, 2-3 years from now, package delivery is no more a dream. It's a reality. Like night operations. First, it used to be like it's difficult to get night operations. Now, night operations are more easier to get. So these are the things where we are seeing the change is taking place, but it's also us as such that are restricting this progress, and that is where the regulations as such cannot be changed just because of a specific need of one company or a state. It has to be a mutual understanding between all the states that this is the progress towards the right direction.
So, Margaret, I'd like you to ask, to answer your own questions about the need for new policies and regulations. How should we address privacy? How should we protect privacy? How do we promote human safety? On law enforcement, how long should law enforcement store data that they collect via drones?
You are very interested in that question, and I'm not sure I have a specific answer for you. I think 180 days is the incidental collection sort of time period, so that's how long law enforcement generally would keep incidental collection information and then sort of get rid of it. So that I think, as Mark said, has been sort of a feature of law enforcement generally. So I maybe the best way to answer the question is to sort of talk about how I see the phases of these types of regulations and policies going. I think the sort of phase one was back in 2015 when the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy were given sort of legal authorities to sort of protect their own stuff. Obviously, that doesn't speak to all of these innovations in the commercial space. Phase two on the sort of legal side and is currently being implemented, I think of as being sort of a 2018. There was a law, the Federal Aviation Reauthorization Act, included a whole big section on UAS, on drones, including a particular section called the Preventing Emerging Threats Act. And what that did was give the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice enhanced legal authorities to, on the law enforcement side, and among other things. And, you know, before that, it was not clear that there were adequate federal sort of penalties for something like an unauthorized operation of a drone. And just as an example, it is being put into practice. On September 3rd, the U.S. Attorney in Philadelphia announced charges against a Bangor, Pennsylvania person in Pennsylvania. He was charged with a number of offenses, but one of them was knowingly operating an aircraft when not registered. He had a DJI Model Phantom 3, which is a drone you can just buy, 7 improvised explosive devices and 10 firearms. And the quote from the U.S. attorney was, "It does not take much imagination to conjure up the enormous harm that can result from the combination of illegal firearms, explosives, and drone aircraft." So they're all levels of law enforcement were sort of involved in this action. So I think it's showing how a law that was passed can actually be put into practice to get, again, the normal sort of, we think of as governance, laws, regulatory system going in this space to deter people from, you know, weaponizing a drone and flying it and terrorizing their neighbors. The future, which I think of as phase three, the future is figuring out, from a public safety perspective, I think is figuring out, and this is the next big space, and we've talked a little bit about this, is putting in the right law enforcement and regulatory framework so that state and local entities can also have the authorities that they need to protect the public. I think that is an underdeveloped space, but I know, and a lot of it has to do with these issues, Daryl, about privacy, thinking through that, what is the right for each community. So this is like the next phase. And just to be very specific, I think, you know, to protect the public going forward, state and local law enforcement are going to need 3 things. They're going to need remote identification, so they can actually identify when there's a drone that's a threat. UAS traffic management, so, you know, understanding what's going on in the space. And then the third thing would be the counter UAS. So this is the, if there is a drone that is a threat, there's, for example, like going to hit critical infrastructure or something, what can state and local law enforcement entities do to actually sort of like pull it out of the sky? And that is, answering that question is a combination of technological developments that I think need to be encouraged, but also in the regulatory space, like making sure it's done right.
Mark, I'm wondering if it's time that we should rethink how we think about airspace. So, you know, when you, and I know both the gentlemen on our panels, on the panel are pilots. So, you know, other than landings and takeoffs, most pilots are operating above 1,000 feet. When we're thinking about drones and unmanned systems, and certainly at the hobbyist level, we're thinking about activities under 400 feet. And so right now, there's a lot of regulation at the pilot level, not so much regulation at the lower levels. But should we start to rethink how we think about the airspace so that you know, the levels are starting to mix a little bit. Drones are developing better capabilities. It used to be there was a line of sight requirement that as long as the operator, the drone was within the line of sight of the operator, there were a few restrictions. But of course, drones now can, you know, stay in the air for an hour. They can go 5 to 10 miles, so they're going well beyond the line of sight. So how should we think about regulations in those areas? And then also, what about no-fly zones? Like, there's some areas around airports, clearly we don't want drone activity there. How broadly should we think about no-fly zones?
Well, Darrell, I think and look at the airspace, I kind of look to where we've been. You know, when we first fielded aircraft, and as they continued to improve, and we in technology and in the markets that they served, we designed the airspace to fit those markets and the technology that was available. And if you look at the unmanned aircraft space, we have a completely new class of aircraft. So we have great new technologies, and we have new markets. And as you said, as a Navy pilot, I rarely flew below 1,000 feet unless I was on a training mission, specific low-level training mission, or taking off or landing, you know, transitory through that. That airspace that we're currently flying all these drones in, no one ever cared about. And evidence of that is we don't monitor that space. And UTM is such a big issue because we didn't do anything down there. So I think we have, and it's somewhat of a fleeting opportunity because no one is talking about doing this. We have an opportunity, a blank canvas, if you will, to design this space. You know, our state partners and local partners, I think there are, you know, opportunities for them to be involved. Local governments permit folks to put scaffolding up and do inspections on buildings, to paint buildings, do window washing. I think that same thing could apply to drones doing those missions, because if I'm an airplane pilot and I'm flying that close to a building, I got bigger problems than your drone. And so I think that there are things that we should do there, especially when you're thinking about, you know, we're talking about small and major aircraft, we're talking about larger ones, talk about urban air mobility in the future. You know, now is the time to design that airspace thinking forward, rather than all of a sudden we get all this in place and now where are we going to put all this stuff? So I think that's an opportunity we need to take advantage of.
Okay, Darshan, I'll put the same question to you, and maybe also add the package delivery component to it, because that is an area that's likely to grow.
Sure. So I would say that you know, a few things to think about is, first of all, the word no-fly zone, it's pretty confusing. Like, you know, even in the manned aviation side, you have different airspaces, you have restricted airspace and all, but all have certain criteria. So, you know, you would call certain areas like airports as responsible fly zones because, you know, when it comes to flying at airports, there's two things. One is flying actually in the airport. Airport inspections, drones are being utilized, can benefit drones, you know, can benefit airports, you know, big airports, small airports alike. You know, small airports, you have limited staff, and limited staff, as a result, you can only do limited checks, and drones can, you know, be integrated into those smaller airports to do inspections of runway, inspections of wildlife, night inspection, day inspection. Now, that's flying within the airport. Now, you have operations around the airport that could be your infrastructure, like rail. You have roads that need to be monitored. Now, all these are traditionally road, infrastructure monitoring that is done in the man side, like bridge inspections and all, which is traditionally done in the, they do not go through airport authorization to get the work done. And these areas are pretty much, there are areas closer to the airport where this is where there has to be a whole, understanding of what's exactly a no-fly zone, like critical infrastructure, you know, power plants and all those things. You can understand those are no-fly zones. Others are responsible flying zones where you have certain restrictions, but certain authorities have that permission or, are granted access based on certain conditions. Like, it's not your Part 107 that's going to really change anything. It's going to be the future regulations that's going to come in. Like, your Part 107, and we were talking sometime back earlier, is like your student pilot license. all it gives you access is that, okay, someday you might become a pilot. But it does not really give you, it's not going to guarantee you that you're going to become a private pilot, instrument pilot, commercial pilot, nothing. It's just a student pilot license that you're part of the training, you're going to do this. Then you have to go through a set amount of process to become an expert. Now, a private pilot cannot fly into clouds, cannot fly in the night. Now, these things are defined in the man side, but when it comes to Part 107, you have your Part 107, you can do anything. No, that's the changes that need to come. Before the airspace, before even we hit the airspace area, it's understanding what your license is valid for. You have to have extra amount of training to operate infrastructure areas, airports. Then it comes to package delivery. You already have 135 operation. Now, what does that 135 operation entails is that you can fly packages. But when it comes to questions like crossing a road, if the road is maintained by the state, who has the right to permit that crossing taking place? So those type of things are a concern when it comes to package deliveries. You'll be crossing roads, you'll be crossing over people, you're going to be crossing over infrastructure that could be critical infrastructure or just, you know, state-owned infrastructure. Who has the right? And that is still a debate that traditionally anything takes off from there is under FAA's jurisdiction. But through the integration pilot program, we are trying, which is still a process, not like we are close to finding a solution to it. It's still trying to identify that. And when it comes to FAA, they have asked us to provide data to prove that crossing roads is a safe thing when it comes to package delivery. So you have your drone, you have parachute on it, you have experts that are trained hours on it, you have packages that are like medical packages that go through the whole permission. You know, you have a whole different permission to use anything beyond just water and stuff. You have to go through all the authority. You have everything. Now comes the big obstacle is you can't fly over a road. So how does that happen? And that change, that is the changes that need to be made, is who has the authority after a certain altitude, and if you're actually flying over a person's property, does he have the right? Does the state have the right? That authority, once we figure that out, then we can start hitting the airspaces and say, okay, up to 400 feet, 100 feet is this, 200 feet is that, you have responsible fly zones, you have restricted fly zones. That's where we have to still work towards, and that is where the problem is that urban air mobility and stuff, it's, 2015, we talked about drones. 2020, we're saying now you're going to be having urban air mobility. 2025, what is the next? It's moving too fast, and people really don't have that, people are lacking patience to work with, agencies that are, you have to understand that these are traditional agencies that are seeing new technology. They're not going to be like, yes, tomorrow you can get anything and everything that's done. You need to have the patience to move forward with them.
So, Margaret, Darshan has raised some interesting questions in terms of who has authority, who should have authority, who should have the right to decide these complex questions. And then also, I'm just curious, given the overlapping jurisdictions and the lack of clarity on some of the rules, how do we think about issues of legal liability when harms take place?
So that is a very good question. I think, again, My answer would be we go to our traditional tools for how we think about legal liability. And I think those tools will work pretty well. The questions that I have going forward, though, relate to, for example, automation. When you have automation, and I think this is a space that needs to be developed from a regulation perspective, from a laws perspective. I think there's a lot of lack of clarity there. Add in something like artificial intelligence, which is another one of these technologies, which is also coming down the pike and will be integrated, I'm sure, at some point with UAS, other technologies, for example, 5G. When you're integrating all these technologies together and you have artificial intelligence, there are some really, really, really tricky questions, I think, that are going to be coming down the pike. I'm not sure as I sit here that I have the answer to those questions, but those
are... Actually, if you did, you probably wouldn't be sitting here.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But I mean, you're right. Like, these are the questions that need to be addressed. And I agree, the technology is just developing at a much faster pace than our ability from a governance perspective to think through these issues and implement them. And again, as I said before, like, infuse our values, our ideas of liability into these technologies so that the right people can be held accountable. So it's probably not a satisfying answer for you, Daryl. If I did have the when I do have the answers, I will get back to you on that. How's that?
Okay.
Invited for the next panel.
Yes. One last question for the panel, then we can open the floor to questions and comments from the audience. And that concerns the need for infrastructure investment. So we're talking about a lot of different aspects of transportation changing: autonomous vehicles, the ride-sharing services, the use of remote sensors, unmanned systems that we've been talking about. How are both state governments as well as federal agencies thinking about infrastructure? Do we need new designs in terms of how we think about urban areas? How are you thinking about that, Mark?
Again, Daryl, I think the first part of the infrastructure is the airspace, and I'm concerned we're not taking advantage of the opportunity to look at the airspace, particularly the below 400 feet airspace, and see what we can do with that to maximize safety as well as the opportunity for drones. As a user, largest non-military drone program in the world, I think so far, I'm concerned about the ability to get performance, scalability, and cost. And so when I hear about infrastructure like UTM, I keep asking, who's going to pay for that? As a pilot who, even at 30,000 feet, has gone and lost radar contact in clear air, I worry about and lost a lot of cell phone calls down low, how well that's going to work, and whether we need to invest that infrastructure. Beyond visual line of sight is the best. Everyone wants that. But I look at, best is the enemy of better, and better is the enemy of good enough. And I'll tell you, we found that visual line of sight, you get done, you walk, you drive to another spot, you do more visual line of sight, is good enough, and it's a lot better than what we had before drones, which was nothing. And so I worry about that we're going to over-regulate and over-equip drones that don't ever need to fly beyond visual line of sight. And I see some of that infrastructure being placed on here because of fear, security, and safety fear. I was in a Nationals game last year, and a guy came over the loudspeaker and said, "Everybody, please get up and go to the concourse." It was a beautiful day. I don't know what was going on. We got to the concourse, and then after we got our beers, we figured out that there was lightning within 10 miles. And so that was a non-material solution to a threat. And so why we can't do that for some drone threats instead of, putting lasers and guns and all sorts of stuff? And have we really thought through, that's great infrastructure, but have we thought through the consequences when we shoot down that drone on the mall and it falls on a D-Day survivor, and it was a 10-year-old kid who didn't know the rules? So I think there's a lot of stuff that we have to think about in terms of policy, in terms of investment before we make that. We might end up with a lot of stuff we don't really want.
Darshan, your thoughts on infrastructure investment?
So infrastructure is what we do. That's what our role is. Department of Transportation, we maintain all the infrastructure in our state, and all the other DOTs do respectively in their states. For us, there may be more models, but I believe there's two models to this. One is to build heliports, drone ports or all these things. That's one model people have been saying is we need to build this over buildings, over certain areas, and, get prepared for the future of urban air mobility. But I also feel like coming from the manned aviation side, for example, North Carolina has 72 public airports. Not all of them are utilized. You have barely one flight or two flights taking off from certain some of these airports, which, some do not even have flights taking off a couple of days. And if you have infrastructure already built in these airports, Why would you want to build a whole different area? You would want to utilize the available resources first. So, you know, like when we, this is also when it was my, during my student pilot days, when I used to be flying, this was in Florida, you know, we used to go from airport to airport looking for cheap fuel because we have to build those 100 hours. And you go to certain airports and there's nothing. But they have a brand new building, they have a brand new tower, you know, they have a tower, but there's nothing around. There's so much space there. If you can utilize those space to create the future, that's great. If that space runs out, then utilize the next space available. But, you know, preparing, you know, investing in something that is future and putting so much money towards it right now and not sure when this is going to be a reality. Is it going to be, initially it used to be 2020 was the date that people talked about. Now that's looking like 2025. Maybe 2030. We have a committee created within a DOT called Beyond Surface Transportation. That's a 2030 vision. So we have already thought about 2030. So we have skipped 2025 out of our range. But for this is something where industry, this is basically something where it's going to be a not the traditional approach. You're going to have industries investing. You'll have state investing. And maybe using federal land and federal areas, also state areas. So for the success of this, it has to be from all sides. But like as Mark mentioned about, you know, counter U.S. technology and, you know, setting up systems like that and all, it's something which people have taken it out of proportion right now. Everyone, you know, everyone wanted a drone. Now everyone wants a counter U.S. technology. you know, we get calls from us being the hotline for all unmanned systems problems in within the state. We get calls like police departments calling us and saying, well, in the shooting range where our folks are practicing, somebody's flying a drone. Their two solution is either shoot it down, or second thing is they wanted to buy a counter U.S. technology. And I'm like, you know, it's you can go and buy. There are very good products out there, but you have to understand the rules around it. People, you know, companies that have created drones have also created a solution to, you know, mitigate it. You have to see that. So I think altogether it is like, when it comes to putting in money towards this technology, is also seeing what traditional resources we have. First use that and then move to the next step.
Okay, Margaret, your thoughts on infrastructure, then we'll take questions from the audience.
I guess I would just note for the audience that there are a couple of notice of proposed rulemakings out on, for example, UAS flight restrictions near critical infrastructure facilities. Actually, this one's scheduled to come out this year. So there are opportunities for people to provide, you know, their comments, their thoughts, their views on these issues and how these types of things can be done better. So I would just would encourage, again, governance, I'm a governance person, encourage everyone to, you know, raise your voice on these issues, get interested and get educated. There are opportunities for just normal Americans to have input on these issues at both the federal and the state levels.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions or comments or microphones coming up. There's a gentleman right here on the aisle. And if you can give us your name and organization, please.
Yeah, good morning. Gary Loberg, Mamluk Ventures. As somebody who spent most of my flying career below 1,000 feet, two comments I'd like to make. One, the assumption in the conversation when we talk UASs here is these were all rotary wing UASs, right? We did not mention fixed wing at all. But my point is that specificity in language, particularly as you write those FARs, is going to be important. The second part is that below 1,000, as I mentioned, is not unoccupied, right? And the pilot workload at 500 and below is, well, let's say considerable. Your time for response is different. When your margins, if you're recommending 400 and below for unmanned systems flying all over the place, one person blinks and you wind up having two different airplanes with spinning parts in close proximity to one another. So as you propose policy, or language, finding a way, whether it's augmented, you know, crash avoidance systems or something else, that's got to be part of the solution set. Because I spent a lot of time with the big sky, little bullet, and that's not always a recipe for success.
Comments from our panel?
Totally agree with that. And, you know, below 1,000 feet, and this is where it comes back to is package delivery. When you're doing it below 1,000 feet, you have your so take an example, medical delivery between hospitals. You have your medevac helicopters. You have your military helicopters that hardly look at NOTAMs. They just fly. And then you have your crop dusters. Again, in a city, you're not going to see a crop duster just flying on top of this thing, but you have diving operations that takes place. You have a lot of stuff that is going on below 1,000 feet. And the thing is, when it comes to fixed-wing, rotor-wing, that's a whole different ballgame there. It's rotor-wings, you know, have the potential to be more restricted in, you know, where they operate. You can control it. But while it comes to fixed-wings, it has needs more space. Then you have the between them, the you know, the hybrid between both of that, which has the capability of a rotor wing and this thing. So you have different technology, different understanding. It's, but it comes back to is, yes, we can regulate airspace at 400 feet, but people then want 500 feet. Then they want 600 feet. They want 700. They just, you know, it's become like the question earlier was about when does data, you know, how long do you store data? We have become data hoarders, basically. We just don't know when to delete anything. And then same way when it comes to airspace, we have 400 feet restriction, but there are over 50% people who still want to fly over 400 feet just because there's a restriction. They're like, yep, 450 feet, I've done it, that's not a big deal. I'm like, okay, you didn't talk to me about it, but that's the thing. It's we are thinking about you know, regulating 400 feet, we may be thinking about regulating 1,000, but it keeps piling up. It has to come, changes have to come within regulation, but also the operators. You know, it's not, that's why I say the part 107 is not enough. It's a start. Once you get more professional people, and as and something else Margaret pointed out was when you do package delivery, the traditional package delivery, the driver stops and he comes and drops the packages, or he has additional help. Will he become a drone pilot? Yes, that's how it is going to be. When before computers came in, you trained the people who were in that role to learn how computers were used. But then the future people you hired were people who understood how to operate a computer. So it is that step-by-step process where regulations have to go, and also training has to be integrated.
Back there, along the wall, there's a microphone coming over to you.
Hi there. Name's Gavin. I'm an intern and student here at Brookings in the Governance Policy Department. And my question is for the panel concerning will the president's recent disclosure of surveillance imagery in August on Twitter have a positive or negative effect on the interest in creating in novel and innovative policy for drone regulations and investment?
That's your question.
So great question. Thank you. So part of my background, I was a Navy pilot for 25 years, and I got to be the drone for part of those missions. I flew photo reconnaissance and found out people don't like when you fly over the country taking pictures. They'll shoot at you or they'll move the stuff out of the way so you can't take pictures. So for me, security is a big deal. I think security needs to be part of every program. And in our program, it was in from the very beginning. We set requirements. Encrypted control link, encrypted payload link, the ability for us to deny or lock out any information sharing. And we worked with companies. We worked with one particular company to develop a solution to that because they didn't meet that requirement. And I think that the conversation right now is kind of on security, as I see it in the press, is kind of bifurcated. There's a genuine concern for security, which I agree with. But security comes from good requirements, not from geography. I'm probably one of many recipients in this room of free credit monitoring, thanks to my personal information being compromised on a server within the government. So location didn't help me there. I think the other issue is a realization, because these drones are very visible, that we don't make a lot of electronics. Maybe we don't make any electronics in the United States anymore. I'm going to buy a Zenith TV lately. You know, so I think there's two conversations that need to go on, and I'm concerned that they're both happening at the same time, and that, you know, banning products never generated the U.S. industry. You know, banning Japanese cars in the 70s never would have kickstarted the U.S. auto industry. And frankly, it's not going to solve the security issue. What's going to solve the security issue is good requirements, both in industry and government, and then adhering to those requirements and only buying products that meet those requirements. So thanks for your question.
And just to add to that, you know, if you start banning the technologies, for example, if you ban, you know, based on geography, you're going to, like, for public safety agencies, 95% of the agencies are not going to be able to use drones, right? Because you don't have a technology that can help them in that price point, that you know, comfort level of training. There's a lot of those things that has to be understood. Banning is not the solution. It's working with the companies, working, finding a solution to it. If there is a problem, there is a solution to it. And if the solution can be met together, that's easier for all the agencies to work with.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question. There's a gentleman right there on the aisle near the back. There's a microphone coming up behind you. If you can give us your name and organization, please.
Yeah, Peter Lewis, I'm with Precision Hawk, and we're on the National Aerospace System Integration Support Contract for the FAA. What I work on primarily as a systems engineer is counter UAS. Darshan, one of the things that you had mentioned when it came to shooting drones out of the sky, I just want to assure everyone that that's not going to be the only methodology of arresting
Absolutely.
A drone, but it's going to happen. So at the FAA, we have three primary concerns. The first one is keeping drones from interfering with manned aircraft. That's the worst thing that could happen, is a drone bringing down a manned aircraft. We saw what happened to Captain Sullenberg with just seagulls bringing that Boeing 757 down. So a drone would really do an efficient job on a fan jet engine. Secondly, we want to keep drones away from people, and thirdly, away from each other. So in that process, and I'll just use the placeholder name right now of LUN, which is Local UAS, or Unmanned Aircraft System Network. That's where Verizon and the other air traffic controllers, so to speak, for drones. We call it USS, UAS Service Suppliers, a.k.a. traffic management companies, are going to combine all of their known drone locations together so they can essentially have one big national map, including all of the territory spaces in Guam, Puerto Rico, et cetera. So that's in the process of getting done. I just want to assure you that, and everyone else here, that we're not sitting around on the UTM or any of these other technologies. We have a lot of people working on it day and night, so, and we're making pretty quick progress. It would be great for it to be quicker, but a lot of progress is being made toward that end. Thanks.
And that's where its education plays a key role in this, is educating people what counter UAS technology is and what is the solution to everything. Is not shooting it down, taking control of it, bringing it over. It's the UTM system as such. Many couple of states are working towards that goal. We ourselves have submitted our model of UTM to FAA, which has given us good feedback and good comments back. The reality is that we are at one side is flying drones and one side is restricting the drones. We have to try and fill that bridge between, which is UTM, and the companies are working with state and local government, with federal government, to make that a reality. And that's why the key thing to this is education. We need to take time to educate our folks within the states. And it's not just FAA's responsibility. It's not the state's responsibility. It's also the industry's responsibility. When you sell your products, educate them also on how to use the products. It's an important part of that.
Okay, that is a good bit of advice on which to end this panel. So I want to thank Mark, Darshan, and Margaret for sharing your views, and thank you very much for coming out as well.